settlers invaded this Palestinian town in the West Bank, smashing up homes, setting homes on fire while they still had Palestinian families inside them, setting cars on fire, assaulting Palestinians. One Palestinian man was killed in another town. You saw this collusion between settlers and between Israeli security forces. There's even video footage of Israeli security forces idling by the side of the road while settlers are in the progress of attacking a Palestinian house. So when you look at this combination of settlers and soldiers and Israeli police either colluding to assault Palestinians or Israeli security forces simply standing by, and then you take into account the fact that there's this potential new guard being set up at the behest of a figurehead of a national camp that saw what happened in Huwara and liked what they saw and said that they wanted to see more of it. It's just a terrifying prospect.
And Natasha, I wanted to ask you about what is occurring within the Israeli defense forces. Clearly, the firing by Netanyahu of the defense minister over the weekend, and then the open letter of a bunch of pilots or reservists protesting these judicial reforms. What is the potential impact on the military of these actions by this extreme right-wing government?
Actually, this morning, the main reservists protest group, that is reserve military officers, signaled that they were going to suspend their protest because of Netanyahu's announcement that he's putting the judicial overhaul plans on pause. They've said that they don't believe what Netanyahu said. They don't trust that he is going to scale back these plans. That's what a lot of other protest leaders have said as well over the last 48 hours. But this was the main reason that the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, said that he believed the overhaul should be frozen, or you know, they should take more time to negotiate what the overhaul was going to look like before pressing ahead with the legislation. For him, this was not a moral or an ethical issue. It was a security issue. He worried that the increasing number of reservists who were signaling that they weren't going to show up to their reserve duty was going to cause real security concerns for the country. He also thought that it made the country look weak before its enemies in the Middle East. So that's really what the impact was on the Israeli military establishment. It's not yet clear what Gallant's future looks like. As of last night, Netanyahu had not sent the mandatory letter to Gallant, giving him 48 hours notice of his firing. As of this morning, I hadn't heard that that letter has been sent. Maybe it has by now. But until that is in place, Gallant is essentially still in his position. So it remains to be seen what Gallant's future holds, and also whether the reservists do indeed go back on strike if the judicial overhaul plans press ahead in a few weeks' time.
And finally, Yusuf, your response and how you're sensing Palestinians feel about Ben-Gvir being put in charge of this new National Guard, this new National Guard unit.
Yeah, well, I think in response to everything that's going on, you know, Palestinians feel very much excluded from the conversation and also don't want to be included in a conversation that ostracizes them as the Israeli debate largely has. But Palestinians, even though Israel is going through tremendous unrest right now, are not just sitting back and enjoying the show. They are, in fact, in a position of extreme vulnerability right now, as they always have been, but in a heightened way, because these religious nationalists who have really, carried out scores of attacks against Palestinians in villages in the West Bank and elsewhere are increasingly being empowered right now. You know, we talk about Ben-Gvir's militia. Ben-Gvir's militia has long existed in the West Bank and in these settlements that are routinely carrying out violence against Palestinians, often in tandem or with at least the protection of the Israeli military. We're talking now about a militia that is going to become increasingly formalized under the direction of a minister in the government, with the protection of a government that has a majority, and with access to greater weapons and resources. Make no mistake about it, these people are looking to harm and eliminate the Palestinian people and are quite transparent about that in their rhetoric. They see this space as space that only belongs to Israeli Jews, and that Palestinians have no space there. That type of eliminationist and genocidal rhetoric is now going to have the backing of a government minister in ways that it didn't have before. So there's certainly greater concern now than I think ever before about the physical safety of Palestinians, who are, as always, going to pay the heaviest price for what is taking place in Israel today.
Well, Yusuf Munayyer, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American analyst, now senior non-resident fellow at Arab Center in Washington, D.C., and Natasha Roth-Rowland, editor and writer at Plus 972 magazine. Next up, we go to Nashville, where a heavily armed former student attacked a private Christian school, killing six people, three of them nine-year-old kids. Stay with us. Klezmer Project Orchestra from the album Klezmer Musicians Against the Wall. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Nashville, Tennessee is mourning after six people were killed in a shooting Monday at a private Christian elementary school. All three students shot and killed were 9 years old. They were identified as Evelyn Dickhouse, Hallie Scruggs, and William Kinney. The adults killed in the mass shooting were identified as Catherine Kuntz, the head of the school, Cynthia Peake, a substitute teacher, and Mike Hill, a custodian who'd worked at the school for 13 years. Police say the shooter was armed with two assault-style weapons and a handgun and shot their way through a side door to enter the school before being killed by police. Officials say the shooter was a former student at the school and had written a manifesto laying out plans for the attack that included maps of the building. A live Fox News report in Nashville about the shooting was interrupted by Ashby Beasley, a gun control advocate and survivor of the July 4th, 2022 mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois.
Aren't you guys tired of covering this? Aren't you guys tired of being here and having to cover all of these mass shootings? I'm from Highland Park, Illinois. My son and I survived a mass shooting over the summer. I am in Tennessee on a family vacation with my son, visiting my sister-in-law. I have been lobbying in D.C. since we survived a mass shooting in July. I have met with over 130 lawmakers. How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them? Gun violence is the number one killer of children and teens. It has overtaken cars.
Monday's attack marked the 129th mass shooting in the United States this year alone, including 13 school shootings. At the White House, President Biden once again called on Congress to pass an assault weapons ban. For more, we go to Nashville, Tennessee, where we're joined by Holly McCall, editor-in-chief of the Tennessee Lookout. Holly, welcome to Democracy Now! Describe what's happening and what you understand at this point, the horror of the mass shooting at this private Christian school.
Well, America sees a lot of mass shootings, but I think to residents of the city where they occur, it doesn't matter what's happened in other cities. And Nashville is still in many ways a small enough city that people know each other. They have some connection to the school. And so there was just shock yesterday morning when the news started to come in very quickly that there was a large police presence in the Green Hills area of Nashville. It's an affluent area of town with several private schools. And, you know, details are still emerging. You did a very good job of encapsulating what we know right now. But, yes, this was a former student. Why exactly they targeted this school? We know that they went there. We haven't seen the manifesto yet. And honestly, I think people here are still just in shock. And it's not even our first mass shooting. We had one less than 5 years ago at a Waffle House that, you know, was responsible for killing five people.
And Holly, what do we know so far on how the mass shooter obtained the two assault rifles and handguns? And could you talk a little bit about the legislation that's been passed in Tennessee recently on guns?
Yes. So according to the Metro Nashville Police Department, the shooter had three weapons with them at the time of the shooting, two semi-automatic rifles. They do appear to be obtained legally. They also had a handgun. And then at their home, police later found two sawed-off shotguns and another weapon. But, you know, it's just not difficult at all in Tennessee to get any type of weapon. Over the last 6 or 7 years, we've seen the legislature increasingly passing laws that even law enforcement officials and law enforcement organizations oppose. The Department of Safety and Homeland Security in Tennessee opposed a bill that is in the legislature right now to drop open carry to 18. It's been 21. In the House, the bill says that you can carry long guns at the age of 18. Technically, you could walk down the hall of the legislative building with a long gun. The Senate dropped that provision, but I don't know that what's going to happen in the House. So that's one thing. We have lawmakers who said the Department of Homeland Security have no constitutional right to protest the bill, even though these law enforcement officers are the ones on the street dealing with this. Last year, the legislature, with the governor's full support, passed a permitless carry bill. You don't even need so much as a permit to get a weapon in Tennessee. You know, we've got handgun, we've got weapons companies that are moving to Tennessee. The governor went out of his way last year to sign the law, the permitless carry law, in a Beretta factory, in a Beretta office that's moved to Tennessee. And it's just it's bizarre to me that there are so many lawmakers here who can only talk about the Second Amendment. I bet they couldn't even name what goes on in many of the other amendments, but this is the one they are focused on.
Police have said the Nashville school shooter is named Audrey Hale and identified as transgender using male pronouns. Police said the motive for the attack, though, remains unclear. Just before the attack, Hale messaged a friend saying they would die by suicide, writing, quote, "One day this will make more sense. I've left behind more than enough evidence that something bad is about to happen." The person that they messaged, called police immediately. Hale once attended the school, which was run by the Covenant Presbyterian Church. The New York Times reports the church is affiliated with the theologically conservative Presbyterian Church in America, whose 2020 report on gender and sexuality notes, quote, "the sinfulness of homosexual and transgender desire, as well as conduct," unquote. So this is Police Chief John Drake being questioned by NBC's Lester Holt Monday night.
So you've also said that Hale identified as trans. Do you believe there is a connection to that?
We feel that she identifies as trans, but we're still in the initial investigation into all of that and if it actually played a role into this incident.
This has set social media ablaze. The far-right conservative Congress member Marjorie Taylor Greene drew outrage when she tweeted in response to the shooting, quote, "How much hormones like testosterone and medications for mental illness was the transgender Nashville school shooter taking? Everyone can stop blaming guns now," Marjorie Taylor Greene said. To this, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responded, quote, "It's absolutely disgusting, and she should be looking into a mirror as to why she's defending and posing with the same weapons that are being used to kill children, teachers, and educators," Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez told The Independent. We just have a minute left, Holly McCall. If you can respond to what is developing right now and the mourning of the overall community.
You know, we're trying to figure out what our next steps are. I will comment on your last remark. It is absurd to imply that this person committed these shootings because they were potentially transgender. That was first reported, by the way, on social media by a right-wing poster. It does seem to be that this person was did identify as male. But law enforcement sources who have read the manifesto says that does not appear to play a role in the motive.
Well, Holly McCall, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Editor-in-chief of the Tennessee Lookout, speaking to us from Nashville. Next up, we continue our remembrance of the human rights advocate and attorney Randall Robinson, who died this weekend at the age of 81. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show continuing our look at the life and legacy of the human rights leader Randall Robinson. He died Friday at the age of 81 in St. Kitts, where he's lived since 2001. Randall Robinson was the founder of Trans Africa, played a key role in the launching of the Free South Africa movement, arrested many times at the South African embassy, and pushed successfully for the imposition of U.S. sanctions against apartheid South Africa. Randall Robinson also spoke out for years against U.S. policy in Haiti. In 2004, he helped expose the U.S. role in the coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was flown against his will to the Central African Republic. 2 weeks after the coup, Aristide defied the United States and flew back to the Caribbean, flying into Jamaica. Randall Robinson accompanied Aristide, flew to the Central African Republic, along with Congressmember Maxine Waters and others, picked up President Aristide and his wife Mildred Aristide, and flew back to the Western Hemisphere. I reported on that flight, joining them on that flight, and interviewed Randall Robinson about the U.S. role in the coup.
Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Rumsfeld should be ashamed of themselves. President Aristide is the democratically elected president, the last time by 92% majority of Haiti, and he has come home to the Caribbean, where he belongs. He is the president democratically elected of the democracy that they overthrew. America ought to be ashamed of itself, and we are proud of the role we've played in bringing him home to his region where he belongs and where we hope he will stay.
Randall Robinson later wrote about the U.S.-backed coup in his book, An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. In 2007, I interviewed Randall Robinson again. He described the day Aristide was ousted.
Later that morning,
about 30 American Special Forces troops in full combat gear and 12 or 13 white Chevy Suburbans of the American Embassy surrounded the Aristide home, took positions on the wall around the home, and you could see the red tracer pattern crisscrossing, crosshatching in the yard of the home. And into the yard came one Chevy Suburban with one of the special forces people fully armed, who was attending Luis Moreno of the American Embassy, who walked into the house and told the president, "I was here when you came back in 94, and I'm here tonight to tell you it's time for you to leave." They removed the president, Moreno, and the American Special Forces from his home, took them to the airport. The president, Mrs. Aristide, and Franz Gabriel took them from their home, boarded them on this large, wide-bodied aircraft with no markings, no tail number, only the sort of large flag, American flag, on the vertical tail assembly, and flew off, making their first refueling stop in the Eastern Caribbean, in Antigua.
Our guest for the hour, Randall Robinson, just up from St. Kitts, where he has been living for the last 6 years. He's just published a new book called An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. Let's talk history for a minute, something the U.S. press doesn't give us very much of. To understand the U.S. role today in Haiti, can you go back in time to how Haiti was founded in 1804?
Well, Haiti was the largest piece of France's global empire. It was its great profit center, that slave colony with 465,000 enslaved Africans working there, many of whom had been soldiers in African armies before they were brought to Haiti. And in August of 1789, or 1791 rather, 40,000 of those slaves revolted and started a war that lasted 12 and a half years under the leadership of an ex-slave named, and a military genius named Toussaint Louverture, and Jean-Jacques Dessalines. And this army of ex-slaves defeated armies, two French armies. The French army before the completion of their revolution, and then another army dispatched by Napoleon under the leadership of his brother-in-law, and then the armies of England and Spain. 150,000 blacks died in that 12 and a half year war, and in January of 1804, rather, they declared Haiti the first free republic in the Americas, because the United States was then a country that held slaves. During the Revolution, Thomas Jefferson said he would like to reduce Toussaint to starvation. George Washington lamented vilified that revolution. The U.S. imposed an embargo, recognized the new French government, but did not recognize the new Haitian free government, and imposed a comprehensive economic embargo on Haiti until the Emancipation Proclamation. In fact, France imposed reparations on Haiti in 1825, and the interest that Haiti had to pay in loans that were American and French loans to service this debt to France absorbed virtually 80% of Haiti's available budget 111 years after the completion of their revolution until 1915. It was only in 1947 that France, that Haiti was able to pay off its debt.
The debt that that was incurred as a result of France not having access to the enslaved people of Haiti.
The Haitians had to pay France for no longer having the privilege of owning Haitian slaves. That revolution provoked the end of slavery in the Americas. And so that's why it is so important that all African people, people generally in the Americas, because Haiti funded and fought in South American revolutions. That's why Haiti is so honored in places like Venezuela, by people like Simon Bolivar. Haiti was central to all of this, and we are in Haiti's debt. But it is for that.
Simon Bolivar came to Haiti.
Haiti, and was given arms, and was given men, was given a printing press, because the Haitians believe that anybody who was enslaved anywhere had a home and a refuge in Haiti. Anybody seeking freedom had a sympathetic ear in Haiti. But because of that, the United States and France and the other Western governments, even the Vatican, made them pay for so terribly long. It's as if the anger of it never abated. I mean, you can hear Frederick Douglass talking about it in the late 1800s, about this thing in the American crawl.
The U.S. government didn't recognize Haiti for decades. The Congress, going back to Thomas Jefferson, afraid that the slave uprising would inspire U.S. slaves.
Would inspire U.S. slaves to revolt against him at in Virginia, and George Washington, and on and on and on. And so they opposed everything that was being done in Haiti to win their freedom.
The U.S. government invaded Haiti in 1915 under Wilson.
Right. Woodrow Wilson invaded Haiti in 1915, and when a Haitian, Peralte, Charlemagne Peralte, organized the Caicos soldiers, these farmers, to fight against this American occupation. The Americans killed him and nailed him to a cross, crucifixion style, and stood him up, his corpse, in a public place in Haiti to demonstrate to Haitians what would be the price of any defense against the American invasion. The U.S. has played a terrible role.
So even as the U.S. and France were at loggerheads after the U.S. invasion of Iraq because France opposed the invasion, that was 2003. In 2004, they were working together.
Working very much together.
Pushing out, forcing out Aristide and bringing him to the Central African Republic.
As a matter of fact, in 2003, late 2003, Aristide organized a reparations conference, and the result of which was a request to France that it repair Haiti by repaying Haiti the $21 billion in current money that Haiti had paid in reparations unjustly to France. Dominique de Villepin responded by sending his sister,
the foreign minister of France,
sending his first sister to Haiti to tell Aristide that it was time for him to leave. And that's how we have the Western world, France, and particularly the United States, have meddled in Haitian affairs. After the abduction of the president, Bush spoke with Chirac on the phone, congratulating each other about how smoothly the abduction of the president had been carried off by both countries.
Randall, you talked about how when President Aristide was president, before he was forced out, he was supposed to be getting hundreds of millions of dollars from the Inter-American Development Bank, I think it was, for health issues.
The loan had been fully approved. It was for $146 million. It was for health issues, for literacy, for things associated with social programs, roads, and some infrastructure projects. The United States blocked that loan. And so, on the one hand, it starved the economy of Haiti. On the other hand, it trained the opposition. On another hand, it armed the paramilitaries. And in the last analysis, American forces invaded and abducted the president.
the U.S. role, how well known is it in Haiti by Haitians?
Oh, and I think it's very well known in Haiti by Haitians. If it were so well known by Americans, our democracy would work better. The problem is with our democracy. It wasn't ever with theirs. The problem is what our undemocratic or the behavior of undemocratic behavior of our government means for struggling democracies across the world, that we feel that we, by divine right, can go in and overthrow governments willy-nilly when they are living under leadership of their own